Good evening and welcome to this week's Zoom webinar from the Middle East Centre. This week's topic is Libya, past, present and future. And I'm delighted to invite you to hear two fantastic speakers who are beaming in from abroad, not exactly from Libya at the moment. They are Mary Fitzgerald and Anas Al-Ghamati. Libya's 2011 uprisings offered an early example of the dangers of the regional upheavals when met with the military might of a recalcitrant dictator. The civil war that ensued and ultimately led to the killing of Gaddafi in October 2011 marked the beginning of a challenging transition that has been held up by repeated setbacks. Complex civil wars, wars by proxy, and shaky ceasefires. The future remains uncertain but deserves our attention. Our two speakers for this evening are Mary Fitzgerald and Anas Al-Ghamati. Mary is a researcher specializing in the Euro-Mediterranean region with a particular focus on Libya. She's reported on and researched Libya since February 2011 and lived there in 2014. An associate fellow of ICSR, King's College London, she has conducted research on Libya for the International Crisis Group, the European Council on Foreign Relations, ECFR, the United States Institute for Peace, USIP, among many others. Previously a journalist, her reporting on Libya has appeared in publication, including in The Economist, Foreign Policy, The New Yorker, Financial Times, and she's also the contributing editor to an edited volume on the Libyan Revolution and its aftermath with Oxford University Press. Anas Al-Ghamati is the founder and director of the Tripoli-based SADC Institute, the first public policy think tank in Libya's history, established in August 2011. He has held several positions in the region and Europe as a visiting fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, a visiting lecturer at the NATO Defense College in Rome, and he is a frequent contributor on Libya and MENA affairs on Al Jazeera, BBC, France 24, and Sky News. Many of us have watched him on a regular basis as a commentator on these channels. He's the author of Libya's Islamists and Salafi Jihadists, The Battle for a Theological Revolution, in the edited volume, The Arab Spring Handbook, published in 2011 by Routledge. And so it gives us great pleasure here in the Middle East Center to invite the two of you to speak. I have omitted to mention myself. I am Usama Al-Azami. I'm a departmental lecturer in contemporary Islamic studies. And it gives me great pleasure to call Mary first, if you can give us your take on how we should look at Libya today in light of a decade of revolution.
Thank you very much, Osama, and thank you very much to the Middle East Center for organizing this event. The week before, Libyans will mark the anniversary of February 17th, the day many Libyans consider was the beginning of the uprising that ultimately brought about the end of the Gaddafi regime in 2011. The protests that started on February 17th, February 15th, actually, a couple of days before, with the arrest of Fatih Terbil, a lawyer who represented families of the victims of the Abu Salim massacre, a massacre in the Abu Salim prison, the most notorious prison in Gaddafi's Libya, which had taken place in 1996, in which around 1,200 prisoners were killed by regime forces, according to Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other human rights organizations. Those anti-regime protests that started and snowballed in Benghazi, Libya's second city, soon tipped into an armed uprising. And I think it's interesting to compare what happened in Libya in early 2011 with what had already happened in Egypt, neighboring Egypt and Tunisia. In that in Libya, those anti-regime protests very quickly became an armed uprising against the regime, partly to do with the regime's own response to those gathering protests that had happened in February. And also, as we know, that armed uprising then later brought about led to a NATO-led intervention mandated by the UN resolution. So all of that made Libya quite distinctive in terms of what happened early on in 2011 and obviously made it very different to Tunisia and Egypt. I arrived in Benghazi about 10 days after those very first anti-regime protests started. And what was striking at that time, this was just before the opposition announced the formation of the National Transitional Council, the body that was to be the international community's interlocutor on the part of the opposition throughout that year. And what was really striking for me in Benghazi in those early days and weeks before the UN resolution mandating the NATO intervention was this sense of fear, a sense of fear in terms of how the regime had already responded to those protests and how the regime may respond as those protests started to quicken. And of course, that was what was behind the whole push for an intervention, the whole push for that UN resolution mandating that intervention. As we know, the uprising continued. The rebels took control of Tripoli, the capital, in August, and Gaddafi was caught by rebels and killed at the hands of rebels in October that year. One thing I was really struck by in late 2011 and early 2012 was how optimistic many of the Libyans who supported the uprising were about the future. And many internationals who were looking at Libya at that time also were quite optimistic. There was a sense that on paper, at least, Libya had all the signs of possibly being one of the success stories of what at that time many people were collectively terming the Arab Spring. On paper, Libya could appear deceptively straightforward, a country of just 6 million people, urbanized, population predominantly, in comparison with, say, Syria and Iraq, a homogenous, relatively homogenous society with not so much the pronounced ethnic cleavages of Syria and Iraq, none of the sectarian cleavages of Syria and Iraq, and an educated population, none of the literacy challenges of neighboring Egypt, for example. And then, of course, on top of all of that, Africa's largest oil reserves. So on paper, Libya appeared to have many of the ingredients that could lead to a success story. But I think what wasn't discussed enough at that time was the fact that you were lifting the lid on 42 years of rule by Muammar Gaddafi. And Gaddafi's Libya wasn't your common garden variety autocracy, if you like. This was a very unique and very idiosyncratic experiment in autocracy. So when Gaddafi's regime collapsed, it soon became more apparent what the nature of that regime was, how Gaddafi ruled, how his 42 years in power had shaped Libyan society, had shaped the way Libyans dealt with each other, interacted with each other, had shaped the institutions of the state. And I think that at those early stages, there wasn't enough understanding of that internationals. I would say as well that between 2011 and 2014, a couple of fateful decisions were taken that really helped set the course for the turbulence of post-Gaddafi Libya. The first fateful decision was to basically give a state salary to those who claimed to have been fighters during the uprising, anti-Gaddafi fighters during the uprising. That led to a situation that from 2012 on, you had over 200,000 men who were armed on state salaries. And that continues today. And that led to the situation from 2014, when Libya tipped into a civil conflict, where you had belligerents on both sides, fighters on both sides, drawing state salaries. And of course, that dynamic also helped encourage the growth of more armed groups. So we saw the armed groups that had emerged during the uprising against Gaddafi, they grew in size, and then we saw the emergence of new groups in the post-2011 period. So that militia dynamic was something that emerged from that fateful decision towards state salaries and is fed by it still today. The other fateful decision was in 2013, when a mix of zero-sum politicking in the first elected parliament of the post-Gaddafi period that was elected in summer 2012, a mix of zero-sum politicking inside that parliament and threats of force by the various armed groups pushing for this at the time brought about a sweeping lustration law, the so-called political isolation law, which barred whole swathes of officials who had connections with the previous regime, thereby hollowing out a lot of expertise in the machinery of the state, institutional expertise in one fell swoop. But it also made the whole question of reconciliation in the post-Gaddafi period all the more difficult. It fed those tensions. And what has been striking to me in recent years is in conversations with people who were some of the strongest proponents at the time of that lustration law, many of them now regret that it was as sweeping as it turned out to be. They believe it was actually a mistake at that time. So it is interesting to talk to Libyans who played key roles either during the 2011 uprising and in the critical period between 2011 and 2014 to see how they look back on it now, the mistakes that were made, what they would have done differently, how they would have done it differently. But I would also add that what is interesting in the last couple of years and indeed concerning is the amount of revisionism we're seeing creep into the conversation on Libya, whether it's the Libyan conversation about what happened in 2011 and since, or indeed the international conversation on Libya. So to give one example, I've noticed over the last year or two, I see several references in different places, media references, et cetera, researchers' references to Libya's 10-year-long civil war, which to me is an extraordinary assertion to make because many would describe what happened in 2011 as civil war, but Libya between 2011 and 2014 was not in a state of civil war. There were skirmishes throughout the country. There were certainly tensions, but at that time, Libyans didn't talk about their country being in a state of civil war. So I think we have to be really careful in terms of how we look back at what happened in 2011, what happened particularly between 2011 and 2014. I see 2014 as the critical year in the post-Gaddafi period, and we'll talk about that later in terms of what happened that year. But you know, I think between 2011 and 2014, we have to see that, examine that separately, and then look at 2014 as this pivotal year. A couple of things about 2014. One thing I think is very important to bear in mind about that year is the impact on Libya of what had happened in Egypt in 2013. And by that, I mean the military coup to oust the government of Mohamed Morsi, and then, of course, what followed there. And it's interesting to see that Libya, in its post-2014 trajectory, tipped more towards echoing what had happened in Egypt than, say, what had happened in Tunisia, where in undoubtedly fragile transition, but Tunisians managed to forge a sense of consensus in their political conversation. They managed to have conversations about the past, transitional justice conversations, etc., that didn't happen in Libya. And I think the impact of what happened in 2013 in Egypt on Libya, in terms of certainly, and I lived in Libya in 2014, the Libyans who wanted a repeat of what had happened in Egypt to happen in Libya, and the Libyans who were fearful that a repeat of what had happened in Egypt in 2013 would happen in 2014, it happened in Libya that year. So that created a very febrile atmosphere in Libya in early 2014, an atmosphere that was really ripe for someone or something to come along and tip the situation, tip the transition as it stood at that point. And that someone did come along. Khalifa Haftar, who I think when we look at the last decade in Libya, stands alone as a singular figure, in terms of his ambitions, in terms of his actions, and critically, and I think this is really important in terms of the conversation about where Libya is at today and in the future, in terms of his backing from an array of external actors, which unfortunately has become a key aspect of the Libyan conflict since 2014. So I would end there with those opening remarks because I think they lead to a wider conversation about what's happened since.
Thank you so much. This has really been a really comprehensive sweep, given how short a time you were given or allotted for this. And it really gives us a sense right from the beginning of 2011 down to the present, the sorts of challenges that we face in a place like Libya, the hope that existed, the polarization that was brought about in a sense in the post-2013 context, and the emergence of Khalifa Haftar, precipitating in a sense Libya's second civil war. And I think also you highlight something which is very important, which is that people don't pay attention to Libya. And so they will make these sort of offhand remarks, even reasonably informed observers, that Libya has been in civil war for 10 years. And of course, you made very clear that that wasn't the case, and that the second civil war emerged out of this effort to imitate what happened in Egypt on the part of someone like Haftar. I think now is an opportune moment for us to hand it over to Anas to give perhaps a perspective on what the future holds. And of course, Anas speaks with considerable experience living within Libya for many years, although he joins us, interestingly enough, from Turkey. So Anas, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Osama. Thank you very much for kindly hosting us today. And thank you again to the Middle East Center for also hosting us today. I don't want to draw in too much from what Mary has said. I think I concur with Mary's kind of timeline. And I think the interesting points that Mary has made kind of tag into where I want to pick up from this. But I will say something about the past, because we are approaching that decade anniversary. And I think it's important because there are so many that watch Libya. There are so many that write on Libya, so many that analyze Libya, that essentially in this conundrum, how do you describe the conflict in Libya? How do you describe, you know, the binary, if you want to go for that? Now, there has been several attempts. There are analysts that try to describe Libya as a battle between Islamists and secularists. There are those that try to define it between its regions, a historic rivalry between the West and the East of Libya. And there are new attempts to try to define it by the greed of the actors, that ideology, that history, that the regionalism plays no role in this, and that it's really just about dollar bills, essentially. So I think with all of that in mind, I've found myself in this conundrum, pondering it for the last year, really, whilst I've been writing various papers for the Institute, whilst I've been analysing the situation from afar. And it's given me a perspective that we can't wrench Libya from its context. We certainly can't wrench it from its context in 2011, and we can't wrench it from its context in the broader region. And what I mean by this is that if we try to understand what happened in 2011 and the series of almost kind of like cardiac arrests that have, these kind of moments that have shaken the system in Libya, but have also drawn thousands of people to the fight. And I agree with what Mary was saying earlier on, there were skirmishes. Many of these moments can be characterized by certain flickers between certain camps in Libya, certain regions in Libya, certain elements of greed that pertains to some of the actors that are making their way into political life. But in my view, I would say that there are two irreconcilable visions of the state today in Libya. And broadly speaking, that is a war that is ravaging the entire region. It's a war that has been going on for many years. It also encompasses what Mary was trying to illustrate about the events in 2013 and the knock-on events that took place in May of 2014 with the emergence of Khalifa Haftar. Now, we can get rooted down in the personalities. We can say to ourselves, well, Libya is complicated, and you know, there are so many differences amongst its people, amongst its different categories of fighters and armed groups from all over the country. But if we think of the times that matter, there are three essential moments. 2011, the moment that galvanized hundreds of thousands of Libyans across the country to either demonstrate or go to the front lines and fight. The very same moment that took place again in 2014 with the emergence of the first civil war after Khalifa Haftar's emergence in 2014. And the latest chapter in that civil war, April 4th, 2019, with the emergence of Khalifa Haftar in Western Libya, trying to overthrow the last UN-backed government, the government of national accord. Why do these moments matter? Because they galvanize, or they were, in my view, these kind of political lightning rod moments. They weren't street-line skirmishes. They weren't neighborhood localized fights. Tens of thousands of civilians, many of whom dropped their weapons in 2011, picked their weapons up again, either in 2014 or in the latest chapter in 2019. They left their small local communities from across the country and made their way to the capital. Why? And I think part of this reason is also trying to describe this event to Libyans, is also trying to describe the experience of Libyans. Libyans have experienced military rule in the past. They experienced the Jamahiriya. Now, we can again go into the analytical rigor of which groups from which cities and so forth But the perception on the ground matters, because that perception provoked so many thousands of people to turn to the front lines. And what I mean about this all in the kind of grand scheme of things is that these two irreconcilable visions are at the root of the diplomatic efforts today to unify the country. And we've been down this road before. We've seen that film before in 2014 and 15 in Libya's first civil war. And I think the essence of that for me and the relevance of this is that there is an inability to acknowledge the differences between the two camps. And I think you can find yourself looking at the emergence of Khalifa Haftar and saying, well, could we find an alternative? Could we find someone that's different? Could we find someone without such a checkered history? But if we monitor or look from where Mary left off in 2014, 15, and look at the subsequent years of negotiations since at least 2016 till 2019, we see that there has been one consistent demand from Khalifa Haftar's side. And that demand has been to reconfigure the presidential council of this UN-backed government. Now, the presidential council is more than just a symbolic figure or a symbolic position. It's the supreme commander of the armed forces. That position is a defining characteristic. It's the defining hallmark of democratic states. It defines the character of your state. If you have a civilian presidency that can ensure the neutrality and subservience of your military, then it's one clear marker, not the only marker, but it's the clearest marker of living in a free and fair society or a democratic state. If you have the inverse, where it's the military that are in control of your presidency, as you find is the model in these old states, I'm living in Turkey at the moment, or I'm staying in Turkey, this Turkish word asker, the Arabic word askeri, the Turkish word for soldier, askeri states, where essentially you can think of 1952 Egypt as one of those models, and models across the region where the state is so finely intertwined with the military that you can't pull one out of the other. Those are military states. And the real hallmark of those states is the presidency, a position that should be held by a civilian, is controlled by the military. And if you don't have that separation of power, if you don't have a subservient military, then essentially you live in a military state. And that is what is essentially being offered by Khalifa Haftar. It's at the heart of the negotiations that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years. And it's a central line that divides not only Libya, and not only the permanent ceasefire line that today stands in the center of Libya, in the city where Gaddafi died in October 2011. What is so important about that aspect is it almost divides the region. East of Sirte, you find there are a lot more Gulf, at least in the Gulf, in the Mashrek, you find military states. West of Sirte, towards the Maghreb, you find that states have accommodated for this, have bridged this, have gone through that. They're maturer and they can accommodate for other challenges. Some of them are constitutional monarchies. Some of them are civilian states and democratic states like Tunisia. And then you have states like Algeria that are undergoing a major, major transformation, but are still negotiating that since the 1990s. So I think for me, that is like Libya's Iron Curtain. And I think that's what, for me, is the only way to describe Libya and not wrench it from its initial context. So I'm not going to go on too much because I think Mary has already given us so much substance from the earlier period. But I think that's the only way to describe it. And I would say, and I have called it this, it is almost like a political culture war that is ravaging the Middle East and North Africa right now. And it's funny that we're there now in 10 years, but I shudder to think what the future holds, because I think given that Libya has resisted, or Libyans have resisted for the last two civil wars, this model, I find it interesting that we're in a new conundrum where that model still hasn't been spoken about in our negotiations, or at least within the UN framework for negotiations. So I'll leave it to you, Osama, to provoke more questions and elicit better answers from Mary and from myself, I hope.
Thank you so much, Anas. And I think you touch on a number of very important points. Your closing remark highlighted the UN's involvement. You know, you have also yourself been, both of you have been in touch with the UN actors in the region. And also, in a sense, there's so much background to give to the Libyan context. And Mary, you did a wonderful historical overview. And Anas, you sort of pointed out some very important aspects of the current Libyan situation. But in a sense, you presupposed a bit of knowledge, in the sense that people aren't always aware of this east-west divide in Libya, the fact that the Western government is backed by the UN. And in essence, Khalifa Haftar, who we've spoken about, has loomed large, very large in the last decade of Syria, although his star seems to be waning considerably in the present and potentially being replaced by other comparable actors to himself who have the support of his backers, as it were. The challenge with someone like him, who is getting so much international support, in fact, including from Western states, but who represents hostility towards a UN-backed government. And so we have this, in a sense, contradiction in the way in which supporters outside the country are interacting with the Libyan situation. And, you know, I would like to ask both of you, in a sense, that to a certain extent, is it the way in which policymakers and, you know, international observers and powerful actors in the international community approach Libya in this very contradictory fashion, which has allowed it to perpetuate its civil war, we'll put it in the plural, its civil wars, without proper resolution? And what could they do differently? And why aren't they doing it? This is kind of the big question about Libya right now. And I'm putting it to you at the beginning. I want to let everyone know you can ask questions. Walter Armbrust will be kindly sort of curating them and sharing them in just a moment. But I just want to start off this conversation by asking both of you this question. How do we address the Libyan conundrum in light of the international contradiction in many respects in the policy world? And Mary, if you'd like to go first, and then Anas, thank you.
Thank you, Osama. Well, again, I think it's instructive to go back to that very early period after the end of the uprising. And again, look at what was done, what could have been done differently, how the trajectory might have turned out differently. And in terms of the international engagement, Libyans from a very early stage at the end of the uprising told the UN, told other internationals, we can do this. We want a light footprint, UN mission. You know, we will be able to oversee our transition. And they were very forceful in that argument, very forceful in their insistence on that. It is interesting now to have conversations with Libyans who insisted that at the time, who now regret that and believe that that was actually a mistake in hindsight. One of the many regrets, in that one of the key challenges in the 3 years, the post-2011 period, those critical years, was DDR, how you deal with these revolutionary brigades and the other armed groups that were starting to spring up in the environment I outlined earlier, how you deal with them. You know, one of the challenges of Gaddafi's legacy was that after his fall, the Libyan army, as it was at that point, had been utterly hollowed out by Gaddafi. Gaddafi came to power in a military coup in 1969, and he was terrified that somebody would plot a coup against him. And there were attempts over the 42 years of his regime. So what he did was he emasculated the army to ensure that it was not capable of a coup against him. Instead, what he did was he empowered brigades led by his own sons. So there was that familial loyalty there. But it meant that after the fall of his regime, security was a major challenge. You had all of these revolutionary groups, many of them regionally based, based in cities and towns, loyalties to their communities, loyalties to their tribes, loyalties to political currents, etc. And no one was able to kind of pull that together. So again, going back to how ripe Libya was in early 2014 for someone or something to come along, that was a key part of it. And, you know, when Khalifa Haftar came along in February 2014 and, you know, issued a video, basically he was accused of attempting a coup at that time. People laughed at that early stage, but when he emerged again in May in Benghazi, he managed to gather a substantial support base. Why? Because Benghazi was a city that was plagued by insecurity, plagued by assassinations, plagued by bombings, etc. So there was an opportunity there, and Haftar came along and took it. Looking back at 2014 again and talking about the kind of international approach to Libya and particularly on the role of external meddlers in the country, which is, you know, a key part of the conflict since 2014, there was an effort to impose narratives on Libya that fit other regional realities outside Libya, but were totally at odds with Libyan realities. Anas mentioned earlier the, you know, this false idea of a secular versus Islamist conflict in Libya. That's not the case. You know, this is not that kind of ideological battle. In fact, since 2014, if there is one driving force in the Libyan conflict. It is a struggle to control Libya's resources, its oil wealth. That's essentially what much of this boils down. Other aspects of the conflict since 2014 are merely ancillary to that. So I think we've seen regional powers since 2014 who were involved in their own regional power struggles that have then played out in Libya. And then more widely, you see countries that are allied with those regional powers, be they France, for example, in Europe, close to the UAE, which is one of the key meddlers in Libya. So all of that has kind of had a knock-on effect on Libyan dynamics. So we can talk about the role of the UN, what the UN could have and should have done better since 2011, but also I think the role of the external actors, specifically the external meddlers, those countries that have been violating the UN arms embargo on Libya blatantly since 2014, and no one has managed to rein them in properly.
Thank you very much, Mary. And I'd just like to remind everyone that you can put in your questions and we hope to get to them straight after Anas responds to the question about international engagement. But Anas, perhaps you can also tie it in with the point that you made about, in a sense, this is a challenge of how we confront military dictatorship as a model that is being appealed to by certain international actors. And Mary kind of highlighted the fact that the chaos that in a sense is precipitated in a context of war, makes some people actually yearn for that sort of authoritarian stability. This, in some respects, a very problematic phrase that reminds us of things like Oriental despotism. And perhaps you could comment, you know, merge those two sort of aspects of the question.
I certainly will. I think, I mean, I want to also touch on this point because I think it's an interesting model. You know, Mary has spoken about how Gaddafi gutted the army after he came to power in 1969 following a military coup. He had done that for the first several decades, but in the early 1990s, he began to realize that there were challenges from Libyans of all stripes. And I think one of the things that he did in 1993, following an attempted coup in the town of Beni Walid in central Libya, was to try to bleed into the lower tier army, which is essentially what it was called under the Gaddafi regime. It was called Jeish Boubacar, named after Boubacar Yunus, the former defense minister of Libya. He bled into it tribal loyalty. One of the reasons for that is that Libya's revolution is also a giveaway as to why this was the case. It wasn't just a national civil war. It wasn't people rushing from east to fight in the west and west to fight in the east. They were intercommunal battles. Libya was truly a fragmentation at the local community level, and it was neighbors fighting against neighbors. One of the reasons for this is that Gaddafi had selected particular tribes that lived on the peripheries of certain cities to blend them into the lower army, not an army that was designed to fight. It was an army that was designed to acquire a certain amount of social and political privilege and a certain amount of power, and in a sense, coup-proof the regime by extending the regime into the bloodlines of local tribes. This was one of the ways in which he felt that he could avoid uprisings, because if there was to be an uprising or a coup or a protest against his rule, it would be neighboring communities that would put it down. He wouldn't have to do it from the central level. He reserved his own power, his own Praetorian Guard, essentially, that was led by his own sons. He reserved that for external opponents, but then had to start fighting on the local level in 2011. It was a very chaotic time. And that model, essentially, is what Khalifa Haftar has mimicked since 2014 with the support of countries like Egypt, countries like the United Arab Emirates, France, and Russia. And the architecture of that is exactly the same. There is a tribal army, for example, in the east of the country. It's often quoted that the east supports Haftar. Which segment of the east? I often find that people say, well, Haftar represents something in the east. If we look at the tribes that are represented in the east, 12% of the tribes or the inhabitants of the east are represented in the senior command of Khalifa Haftar's army. So 88% of the population are not represented. So there is something that is going on. It's ironic that only a small portion of the society is represented in an army that often calls itself the Libyan National Army. Now, that framework, that architecture is so important because it's concealed behind the narratives that Mary was talking about. It's concealed as a Libyan National Army that is fighting against, you know, a national threat of either Islamists and terrorists, a narrative that was imposed essentially from the outside. And it's quite funny because when you look at the journalists that came to Eastern Libya in 2014 and asked, what is happening here? Who are you? Well, where are the army and we're fighting ISIS or Al-Qaeda? In Arabic, that wasn't the case. If you look at Arabic media, they would often say, well, we're the Bedouin and we're fighting the Jews and the Turks over there. I often find that peculiar, because it would often that kind of rhetoric that conceals, it's easy to conceal it in English. It's not so easy to conceal it in a local language. And any anthropologist would have picked up on this in 2014. And any anthropologist would pick up on the structures, the embedded tribalism within these structures that is being carved out now for the last 6-7 years. Now, I think it's funny that the need for narrative to impose itself on that was important, because they're playing from the same playbook. Haftar also has a Praetorian Guard led by his own sons and his son-in-law, with a very kind of discreet loyalty. It's either Fawdhr or Fatwa. So you have his sons and his son-in-law, or you have radical Salafi Madkhalis from Saudi Arabia, who follow a fatwa from their primal Sheikh Rabi' al-Madkhali in Saudi Arabia, who has designated Khalifa Haftar as the ruler of Libya since 2015. It's a very peculiar branch, a very peculiar architecture of an army. But it is one that Libya has an experience with. That, for me, was the hallmark of the Jamahiriya under Gaddafi. So I think that's where I leave the subject of the military. But it also gives you an idea about, if that's what's been going on for the last 7 years, Khalifa Haftar has not been legitimately the head of an army since 2015, December 17, 2015. How has he been able to go from a small foothold in the east of the country to trying to overthrow the UN-backed government in Tripoli within 4 years? And I think what's been so peculiar about this, and why it's so relevant to a decade on, is that in 2011, when the UN passed Resolution 1973, there were skirmishes at the UN Security Council. Russia abstained, China wasn't happy, but they passed that legislation and it gave a green light to NATO to intervene in April 2011. If we go 10 years later, states that were worried, particularly regional states like the United Arab Emirates, like Saudi Arabia, who were fearful of the Arab Spring at that time, they wised up, and especially the UAE, who have transformed from a medium power to one of the most aggressive and activist powers the region has ever seen. And the way they've been able to accomplish that is through something that no one, I think, really predicted in 2011. Essentially a very simple tool, procuring diplomatic veto at the UN Security Council level and at the European Union level, by bridging and forging alliances with France, who has a very crucial role in being both the EU member state and a member of the UN Security Council, but also Russia, who also play that role with them at the UN Security Council. And by being able to do that, they've not only been able to, you know, break international norms, and I'm saying, because we've got such little time to go through with this, but an example of that is that when you think of the ways in which not only wars are fought, but how wars are funded, the most peculiar aspect of the past decade for me is something that's quite banal. Russia funded Khalifa Haftar by counterfeiting or printing counterfeit Libyan currency in their own national mint, Gosnak, and sending around $10 billion worth to the east of Libya. No country on the planet would be able to do this, apart from Russia, by being able to break those kind of norms, international financial norms, in the way that it has. So just to summarize this kind of point, by being able to erode those norms and being able to conceal the actions, you know, of a power like the UAE or Egypt or Khalifa Haftar, that procurement of a diplomatic veto was so crucial, because Khalifa Haftar wasn't only able to just launch that war. He was able to launch it on April 4th, 2019, in the presence of the chief of the UN, Antonio Guterres, who had just arrived in Tripoli to announce a national reconciliation conference. It's baffling, but it's only now, given it's been a decade, that we can kind of absorb such, you know, major, major transformations in not only in Libya, but in the international order that we rely upon to give us stability and to give us security.
Can I interject a couple of questions now? We've had a large number of questions coming in, and we're not going to have time to get through anywhere near all of them, but let me ask a couple. One is from Patrick Jeffrey, who is the EU International Relations and Diplomacy Studies. And his question has to do with something you just mentioned, which is that the Russian forces remain in the Sirte of Jufra axis following the January deadline for their departure enshrined in the nationwide ceasefire. And his question, quite generally, is what does Russia hope to gain from its involvement in Libya? What is their end game? And let me throw out another question to you as well, because we're going to run out of time. And this one is from Peter Millett, who was the British ambassador to Libya from 2015 to 2018. And his question is that the UK is often seen by Libyans as an important player, but in recent years, the British government has been preoccupied by its own problems with Brexit and with COVID. But his question is, what role can the UK government play now to bolster the UN agreement and to support a possible unity government and help build stability in Libya? So two questions, one to do with Russia, the other to do with the UK, to both of you, I think. The first one is to do with Russia. Why is Russia involved in this? And what do they hope to gain from it?
Anas, if you would like to take that.
Yeah, sure, I'll take that quickly and then I'll let you take the second question, Mary. But in a nutshell, Russia's playing a very intriguing game, and I would say that the only way to understand it is by looking at the other players. The other players are playing checkers. They have a very binary set of choices in front of them. Either they're trying to support the UN-backed government in establishing essentially a civilian democratic state, I would say, or they're trying to, you know, return Libya to a military-led or a military, or to return Libya to military rule. And there are very strict binary choices and binary objectives in what they're doing in Libya. Turkey perhaps is the peculiar actor in that it has geostrategic ambitions, given that there is the Eastern Mediterranean gas base in there. But Russia is not playing checkers. Russia's playing chess. Russia has been able to carve out a space in Sir Jufra that is more important than just Libya. Libya in the Southern Mediterranean is at the southern flank of NATO. And by being able to just forge and carve out that role, we can't only just see it in the context of their repositioning of that in the last 6 months or in July of 2020, but go back to Watford in December 8th, 2020. Go back to the comments of Emmanuel Macron at the last NATO conference. He called NATO brain dead. You know, essentially called into question why NATO's alliance exists. Why should we be anti-Russian? Russia is going to be a crucial partner for a country like France in sub-Saharan Africa, where France has a very key interest in making sure it has a foothold in southern Libya into the Sahara and Sahel space. But when you look at the way that NATO is brought into action, you know, it's a long and it's a very old machine. And the logic is that, you know, there are different logics that underpin each state within NATO. Its eastern flank, its Baltic states, feel Russia's presence every single day. They see a buildup of munitions. They see an aggressive Russia moving, whether it's in its actions in Georgia or in Ukraine, in Crimea. But then you have states that are in the Mediterranean or in the western and southern flank of NATO that don't see Russia and don't feel that problem. And Russia has been able to carve out a space right in the southern Mediterranean and really call into question two key actors: Turkey, who supports the GNA, and France, who support Haftar and the Libyan National Army, the LNA. And the fusion, or the massive fissure that has erupted between those two key member states of NATO, is essentially, I think, really what Russia's end goal is. This isn't about Libya, and it isn't about having a decisive win. They had a decisive win in Syria. They could have called it, I think, and had a decisive win in Libya, but a protracted conflict really plays into Russia's hands. And I would say, just watch it in that sense. Everyone else is playing checkers, but Russia continues to play chess to our detriment.
Okay, what about the role of the UK? Is there a role of the UK in Libyan affairs?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is bring the conversation back to what's happening in Libya today and what's happening on the ground in Libya, because I think very often the conversation on Libya has become a very geopolitical conversation that is quite disconnected from what's going on in the ground in terms of some of the dynamics shaping Libyan society at the moment. And right now we have just had a UN-led dialogue forum that elected a new executive authority to put together a cabinet and oversee the country for the next 10 months until planned elections in December. Parliamentary and presidential elections are what are planned. And these elections will be the first elections that Libya has experienced since 2014. Libya has actually only had three sets of national elections since the fall of Gaddafi. One parliamentary election in 2012. Then there were elections to form a constitutional committee, a committee tasked with writing Libya's first constitution in decades. And then in 2014, the second set of parliamentary elections. And one thing I think many are wondering about, you know, if we reach a stage where in December elections can take place, and there are all kinds of caveats about that, because a lot of things can happen in the 10 months in between. But say we do reach that point, there are many people wondering, first of all, what kind of turnout we might see in those elections. It was very striking to watch what happened to the kind of euphoria, if you like, about democracy, a democratic transition amongst Libyans. In 2012, there was an enormous turnout for those first elections. I was in Libya for that election day. I was in Benghazi. There was a euphoria. There was a sense that Libya had gone another important step in its transition. Fast forward to 2014, and the turnout plummeted. It was a tiny turnout and something that undermined the legitimacy of the resulting parliament. There are real concerns that we may face into another low turnout in December. Some of the elections more recently in Libya for municipal councils have shown a low turnout. So there is a question as to whether Libyans as a society are basically not so enamored with the idea of democracy. And that, of course, raises real concerns in terms of what kind of trajectory Libya might be on in terms of its transition. You know, Haftar spoke to a significant percentage of the Libyan population that felt that their most important priority was security. They felt they wanted what Haftar presented, which was a quasi-military rule, if you like, or at least that model. He aspired to the Egyptian model in many respects. And that spoke to a lot of Libyans. I think the question now goes back to what Anna said earlier is, you know, the competing visions for what Libyans would like to see as the Libyan state. What does the Libyan state look like in the future? Will it be a democratic civil state? Will it be some kind of attempt at a quasi-military rule? Haftar, remember, is in his mid-70s. So I think that's worth bearing in mind as well. The question of what may be left once Haftar is no longer on the scene in terms of what he has constructed in eastern Libya, the forces he has built up, the forces he and his supporters call an army, what will the legacy of that be? And the polarization we've seen within Libyan society over the last 6 years, the deep wedge that has formed between East and West Libya, driven by media narratives. You know, there's been an intense war of narratives in Libya over the last 6 years. So I think looking forward, this question of what does a future Libyan state look like? What kind of state do Libyans want at this point after the last decade where they have experienced democracy, at least in the form of minimally of elections? What do they want now and what do they aspire to? I often remember in 2011, after the uprising, many Libyans told foreign journalists, you know, just wait, within 5 or 10 years, Libya will be like a Dubai on the Mediterranean. That's what we aspire to. Other Libyans said they wanted to be a Switzerland on the Mediterranean. 10 years on, I think the question of what a future Libyan state will look like, what Libya will look like 10 years hence, I think that's the interesting question in terms of what kind of state will actually emerge from what we see now.
Okay. I also had a question from Michael Willis in relation to one of the neighboring states, which I don't think has been mentioned once in the whole evening, but which arguably has a significant stake in Libyan affairs, which is Algeria. Can either of you say anything about the role of Algeria in the current Libyan situation?
I think Algeria, I'll make this very brief. In fact, we're publishing, hopefully in the next week, a publication called The Great Game, and looking at the 12 powers that have shaped Libya over the past decade, Algeria being one of them. And I think actually the author actually is in the room with us, Yahya Zubair. So I think I'd probably defer to him to speak about this, but having looked at Algeria over the past decade, Algeria is undergoing its own transformation with the Hirak over the past 18 months. And I think despite those changes, I think Algeria's true role has been often called that hidden giant. And I think that's a very easy kind of statement to make. But I think Algeria had played a diplomatic role in Libya's last civil war. But I think going forward, Algeria is concerned with two things. Power politics, you know, and the regional interference, particularly by Egypt, and their own struggle to reshape the hegemony over the African Union, over North Africa, following the fall of Gaddafi. But there's a lot that hinges on Algeria's own domestic changes, but it's still too really early. I think Algeria could have played its hand many, many years ago and has decided, given its long history of non-interference, it's decided that it prefers diplomacy over interfering in the domestic affairs of a neighboring state.
Mary, do you have anything to add to that?
Sorry, Walter, can I just pick up very quickly on Mary's last points?
Yes,
please. There's something that's very important. As we are moving towards elections over the next 10 months, I think what's so important and what's so interesting about Libya's experience with the last decade is the degradation of daily life. And I think what's so fascinating about that is it's a very, very lived experience. It's such a brutal experience. The Danish Refugee Council in the summer during COVID at its peak said that living conditions in Libya were apocalyptic. You know, if you just think about that for a moment and think what that means, daily water cuts. There were water cuts to 3 million people at one point during the last civil war. There are electricity cuts that are not only intermittent now, but are entire blackouts in some places of the country for days. The inability to get cash, physical cash, and Libya is a cash economy, the inability to get cash frequently, conveniently, or predictably for nearly a decade. Just think what that does to the political psyche of your average person, to your any person, in fact, in the country. And think about what that does to your decision-making when you move towards elections. We often think about ourselves in Europe or in the UK, you know, thinking about the decision-making that was taking place during Brexit. You know, irrespective of which way one stands on that discussion, it was the way in which people really believed that their lives were at risk, and it was the way in which they believed their lives needed to change, but their daily living conditions hadn't changed at that point. If we look at what's happened in Libya over the past decade, there has been a major transformation in that. And what concerns me is that when you're living in such quote unquote apocalyptic conditions, how do you decide soberly? How do you make such a good decision? And do you not get more drawn in? Do you not become more ripened to making quite extreme decisions? Do you not become more ripened to listening to quite simple ideas, very simple lethal ideas about explaining a very complex phenomena, fiscal, service delivery, geopolitics, and you start saying, well, why don't we just give it to so-and-so? Why don't we give it to this side or that side? And I think to go back to what Mary was saying, that experience is something that I think essentially didn't need to happen. Irrespective of the disputes and the conflicts in Libya over the last 6 years, why has electricity not been managed? You don't need a prime minister from the east or for the west to have your electricity infrastructure repaired. And that's something that really concerns Libyans. I'll leave this on an anecdote. I was in Spain last year, and the Spanish Foreign Ministry, to their credit, who don't have much bandwidth in Libya, asked, what could we do to help Libyans? Could we support the UN mission? Could we talk on diplomacy? Could we talk on national reconciliation? And I thought, you don't have the bandwidth. But I did joke and in jest, I said, if you want every single Libyan, east, west, and south, to love you, have a conference about delivering electricity in Libya or delivering water in Libya. They will love you for that. You know, just break the mold of the continuous conversations and essentially respond to very desperate needs that Libyans are living under, that I would say indirectly have shaped the minds of many Libyans that today, as Mary was saying, are asking themselves, who should we support? And making quick binary decisions on things that are quite complex.
Thank you, that's very helpful. And actually, we have had a number of questions. I'll just summarize them, asking for more information about the local dynamics of what's going on in Libya, both in terms of what's going on now, in terms of the balance between any attempt that somebody might make for state building as opposed to security, but also in the longer term, sort of the social conditions leading up to the fall of Gaddafi. I don't know if we have time for any more discussion, but
if I could just make a few final points, I think following on from what Anna said about the discontent in Libya over living conditions and, you know, last August, we saw the biggest demonstrations, the biggest nationwide demonstrations in Libya since 2011. They were basically driven by grievances over widespread corruption, poor living conditions, and just the frustrations that come from all of that. One final point, if you look at the demographics of Libya, Libya is a predominantly youthful population. Some two-thirds of the population are under the age of 30. We're now looking at a younger generation that has no real lived memory of the Gaddafi era. So talking about the Gaddafi era, you know, framing what's happening now through that particular lens doesn't resonate with that generation. It's a generation that has been shaped by the experience of 2011 and by the experience of the last decade. And I think we really need to think a little bit more about that generation that is emerging, how it sees the Libyan state, how it sees its future, its demands, its grievances, the very real frustrations it feels right now. And One final word in terms of those, including the UK and other countries that are wondering what they can do in terms of supporting this new transitional period, should it succeed after this new executive has been established. I think thinking about Libya in those terms, those future terms, and looking at that younger generation, looking at what it's demanding, how it has been shaped, I think that's key, because it's often something that is missing in the conversation on Libya, just that youthful segment and how they may view things very differently from the older political figures that international interlocutors are dealing with.
Thank you very much, Mary. This has really been an amazing conversation, a very wide-ranging conversation, and it's nice to sort of end on a note of youth, youthful hope, you could say, because in a sense, the youth represent the future of this country going for decades. And I think it's entirely to the point to highlight, including to the policymakers in the audience and the people involved in thinking about how Britain or other countries should engage in the region, that aspect of the region be highlighted. I'd like to thank you both, Mary and Ernest. I'd like to thank Walter for handling the questions. I'd like to apologize to those whose questions we didn't get to, but this has really been a wonderfully informative evening about a very challenging subject, and one which I hope we will try to give more attention to. It's one of the topics that Libya doesn't get as much attention as many of us would like, and it persists in facing a number of challenges as a consequence, I think. So with that, I'd like to wish you all a wonderful evening and a wonderful weekend in advance, and see you in a week's time. In a week, we will have, actually, I'm not entirely certain who will be presenting next week. So if one of my colleagues could very kindly perhaps jump in and inform us.
We will be welcoming Vitaly Naumkin and Alexei Vasilyev, who will be speaking about Russia in the decades since the Arab uprisings of 2011.
How apposite after a discussion on Libya. So we would love to have you there in a week's time. Until then, good evening from Oxford.